Good morning, everyone. You're listening to Green Left Radio. And on the line, we're very happy to have a special guest for our program this week, a filmmaker, Pablo Navita. Pablo has been a filmmaker, is quite a documentary filmmaker who's made a number of films, covering Latin America, politics and so on. And his latest film is about the Free Julian Assange campaign titled No Extradition, Julian Assange's Father and the Struggle for His Son's Freedom. So we have Pablo on the line here to talk a bit about the documentary because Green Left will be organising, is supporting an upcoming film screening of the film this coming Saturday. And, I would like to find out from you, Pablo, what can you tell us, I guess, about a bit the background to the film?
Sure. Firstly, thanks for inviting me on and thanks to Green Left for supporting this screening on Saturday. I was in Australia a couple of years ago showing a film. Actually, I've been there twice to show films and both times I think I've done things with Green Left supporting. So it's always nice to collaborate and with you guys. So this film is a 35 minute documentary that I made. Kind of how did it happen, I guess, was I was covering some of the protests, some of the court cases around the Assange case for Telesur, the Pan Latin American channel based in Caracas, for their English channel and for their Spanish channel. And through that, I kind of just, started covering and starting reading more about the case. And I was already aware of what was going on with Julian Assange. But the more I read, the more I was on the ground, I just felt like it was an injustice of epic proportions that was being carried out. And two, I just saw that there was this kind of small band of very dedicated activists, grassroots supporters who would never appear in the media because they were never asked to be interviewed. But that come rain or shine were there for, trying to campaign and do what they could for Julian's freedom. So I was then put in touch with Julian's father, John Shipton, by John Pilger, who I imagine all of Green Left listeners will know, the great Australian documentary filmmaker and journalist who I knew, who I know because I worked with him in 2005 on a film called The War on Democracy. I was his Venezuela researcher. I was living in Venezuela. And so we've stayed in touch. He put me in touch with John Shipton. I interviewed him. And I was just struck by him as a person, his kind of mild mannered way of speaking, but he's also sort of fierce sort of determination to free his son. And I just thought why don't I do a short documentary based around a few filmings with him at events coupled with this other side, which I thought was also important. And I just wanted to put those two together. And that's essentially how this film came about. And it's kind of brief context, I guess.
Yeah, thanks for that, Pablo. I want to talk a bit about the specifics of the film, but I was wondering, just for the, I guess, the benefits of the listeners, what can you, I guess, tell us, especially from your experiences kind of making the film, about, I guess, the whole background for the whole Free Julian Assange kind of campaign, like the particular kind of context of where it seemed. I mean, because one of the things is, the whole Julian Assange kind of story was a very big thing when I was first getting into politics, which was in 2013. And then, of course, since then, a bit of a shame, the whole kind of campaign for kind of Julian Assange has kind of dropped off. So that's sort of the background for myself I come from. So I guess what is sort of some of the kind of background kind of information on this sort of current status of Julian Assange and the campaign that you could tell us about?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't speak on behalf of the sort of grassroots UK campaign. I kind of see it as an outsider. Although, having said that, my mother appears in the film briefly, an excerpt of a speech she gives outside the Ecuadorian embassy. And my mother has been very active in the grassroots London campaign. She's a, you know, my you know, my name is Pablo Navarrete. It's not a typically British name. My parents are Chilean, who were forced to flee Chile after the Pinochet coup in 1973. Both my parents, you know, were political prisoners and suffered, you know, they were suffered in those concentration camps and came to the UK. And my mum is someone that quite early on actually has become involved in this grassroots campaign, been, you know, one of those that come rain or shine is at Belmarsh or is at Westminster Crown Court. So that's actually another connection as to why I you know, the connection I had to the case through my mum was a little bit more personal. So in terms of where the case is at, I mean, I think, as you say, I think in 2013, you know, Julian Assange was widely kind of lauded for the work he was doing exposing US war crimes and a number of other leaks. And subsequent to that, obviously came these sexual assault accusations, which really, it has now transpired that they, you know, they were highly irregular. Would be the best, the most diplomatic way of sort of concluding as to how these unfolded. I mean, the more and more I hear about it, and here I think I would really recommend people read the articles of Matt Kennard and Declassified UK, which is a new independent media website on the UK security state. And Matt Kennard is a former Financial Times journalist who, alongside with Mark Curtis, who is basically the UK's answer to Noam Chomsky, the two of them have set about basically exposing so much around the UK security state, and on the case of Assange have exposed the sort of quite shameless irregularities taking place in the UK judiciary system, but also himself and others have exposed the irregularities around what happened with how that rape or how those sexual violence accusations should have been investigated, and what the British government did and the British judiciary did to basically stall those. And so I think those accusations were the things that took away the large part of Julian's support from the general public. It made certainly people in the UK very wary of supporting Julian, because there was this narrative imposed on people that if you supported Julian, you were effectively advocating or a supporter of rape. I mean, that was at its crudest. That was the kind of narrative that was imposed, and people that, you know, weren't able to properly follow the case were inhibited, and you know, when we look back, it would be interesting to see to what extent this was, you know, there is sufficient evidence to conclude that this probably was some kind of campaign from the security services, precisely because they knew that it would be so effective in taking away Julian's support. So yeah, I think there has, you know, the general public has been, he has been demonized. There's been a character assassination of Julian, which has obviously affected his support base, the amount of people willing to advocate for him. Things have changed in the last couple of months, I think, in terms of a kind of level of support from media groups, from Amnesty, from journalist unions that are increasingly sort of advocating, as you know, on Monday, the 7th of September, the extradition trial kind of starts again, and the kind of, in theory, the final set of hearings. And so there is a kind of momentum towards supporting Assange again, even by newspapers such as The Guardian in the UK, which is, for your listeners that might not know, is supposed to be the most progressive newspaper, and worked with Julian initially on publishing the leaks, then fell out with him, and actually has been at the forefront of some of the worst smearing of Julian and the case in general in the UK, but now has come out with editorials sort of advocating and saying, you know, it would, the repercussions for press freedom were he to be extradited to the US and face up to 175 years in prison. The kind of pennies dropped with journalists in terms of what this means for their own capacity to exercise journalism and expose and to be handle leaked information. So, I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but I would say that there's more support than there has been for a while. What's been really shameful, I would say, is the lack of support from the British media political class, sorry, and that's across the board. And obviously under Jeremy Corbyn, there was some level of support, but I think in the context of the, you know, relentless attacks that he was subjected to and character assassination, I think that his team didn't feel that the Julian Assange case was something that they were willing to expend massive amounts of political capital on. And now, obviously, we have a new Labour Party leader who's much more sort of back to business, sort of, you know, pretty much a man. I mean, he's a Sir Keir Starmer, a man of the establishment, and a man who was actually the head of the Crown Prosecution Service, the CPS, when a lot of the sort of when the Swedish judiciary was trying to investigate this rape. And there are damning emails, again, exposed by Matt Kennard, who's got a very, you know, a fascinating article for The Grey Zone, a US media outlet, where he poses five questions to Keir Starmer around what, you know, and one of them includes the Assange case. So the political class in the UK has been shameful. There is a grassroots campaign and there is an increasing amount of media watchdogs. To what extent this can really put pressure on the Johnson government to not succumb to this blatantly political persecution, which it has already, you know, taken part of. I mean, he's in Belmarsh, has hardly had access to his family, his lawyers. His health is, you know, not good. He's not well. He's been denied access to doctors. You know, the British state has, I would say, verging on torture. I mean, the UN rapporteur Nils Meltzer has said that the UK is responsible for at least psychological torture. So yeah, I mean, I think to sum it up, I think all of this has meant that the average person in Britain is not aware that there is a journalist in a high security prison in South London, which is meant to be for the most dangerous criminals in London and or in the UK, who's basically a political prisoner of the British government on behalf of the US government. And that's kind of the basic facts of this case, which are not, which are, you know, should have the general population up in arms and the political and media class up in arms, but that, you know, that's not the case. And I think some of what I've just talked about is the reason why that isn't the case.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. I think that is actually kind of a bit of a useful kind of background, especially kind of drawing, I guess, on the British sort of perspective, which you gave kind of insight. What can you tell us now going into the film? What can you tell us about the film, I guess, in terms of civics, especially in terms of how it contributes, I guess, to this whole campaign to free Julian Assange?
Yeah, I mean, I don't pretend to be a kind of one of these. I don't think even the BBC journalists who say they're unbiased even believe that. But certainly, I've always, you know, I've worked on. My parents are Chilean. The focus of my journalism and my documentary films has always been Latin America. So in that sense, the Julian Assange, what was happening to Julian, kind of made me feel that I had to, for the first time in a documentary, cover an issue that was, I guess, UK based. And also because I've been covering the UK for Telesword, it's kind of given me a much more of a desire to sort of cover the injustices happening, you know, where I live, where I was born. You know, even though I've lived in Latin America, I've lived in the US. I was born, went to school here, went to university here. I live here now with my family. So, this has made me want to cover a UK issue for the first time. And the film, as I say, tries to balance a kind of more of a human approach. It's an observational film in that sense. I've made films before, which I'm kind of having worked with John Pilger, you know, I tried to, I guess, in my first film, emulate some of that style, the VO, some of the archive. But I think the last two films I've made have been observational films. And I think with this film, it's a simple, you know, we spent three different filming sort of sessions with John at different events. One was a concert outside the Home Office. One was a visit to Belmarsh and an award ceremony outside Belmarsh. And the last one was his trip to go and see Julian on the train again. And so within, you know, interspersed to that are the kind of scenes, some of the scenes that I filmed outside the Magistrates Court, a big event that was done in a church in central London with a number of speakers. So it's a film that just tries to balance the kind of what a father feels on a quite human level with the kind of wider politics of the case, and that's given by and also to sort of, you know, provide a platform a little bit for these what I consider sort of heroes or sheroes, people who are just completely ignored, if not denigrated by the mainstream media as kind of oddballs or whatever, people that, you know, who recognize the injustice, which everyone should recognize, and who have, you know, campaigned. So the film tries to just, in a quite simple way, do all that in 35 minutes. And yeah, and I hope that your listeners will tune in on Saturday, and there'll be a Q&A with, Mary Costakidis, I understand, and Mo actually is important. It's the first time he does a Q&A for the film, and Mo features in the film. He's a journalist who is probably the journalist here in the UK that's covered the case the most systematically. He's been at pretty much all the hearings, you know, whenever, you know, the media should have been at, he was there, and he knows probably more about the case than anyone else. And I think he's also, you know, a kind of hero of journalism, the kind of person who's been following this case in a way that most journalists should have from the start, but haven't. So I think I'm really looking forward to the Q&A with Mo, with Mary, and the chaired by Green Left.
Actually, that adds into another question, because one of the from someone who's been trying to promote the film around, one of the sort of attractive things about the documentary has been a number of the kind of guests and people that you talk to in this film. From my understanding, there is a discussion with the famous sort of pop star MIA, and I kind of wanted to hear from you what are some of the people and that you hear from, I guess, in this particular film.
Well, with MIA, I mean, MIA, the reality is that MIA performed at this big event, so she's a kind of we show some of her performance, so we don't actually sit down and talk to her, because I think the idea, this film isn't really about, it's not a kind of talking heads interview. It's not like get a number of famous people, sit down. It's more of a you know, it's an observational film in a way, but it's not a classic observational film in the sense that we try and make, so for example, this event in this church where John Pilger spoke, a number of people spoke. There were about 10 very high profile speakers. But obviously I can't make a film where you have, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of, you know, speaker after speaker. I mean, it's not a summary of an event. But what I really wanted to do was to try and look at a way of fitting this in to this film, which in a way that was kind of dynamic, but that gave this really important context to people. Because I think sometimes and this is going into a bit filmmaking now, the reason why I always kind of perhaps shied away from observational filmmaking was because I'd seen a number of films that were, you know, really interesting, really emotional, powerful, dealing with certain issues which I knew a little bit about. And whilst they were great films in the sense that as a kind of on a micro level, on the individual level, I always felt that the absence of context meant that the view that the person watching it, whilst, you know, appreciating it on the level of that micro level, wasn't left with much information about the wider context. And obviously, as someone as a left wing filmmaker and journalist, sort of, you know, systemic views on the world and critiques are kind of important for me. And I've always, I think, been part of the films I make. So I was, in a way, it was a kind of a little bit of an experiment to see how I could, you know, how I could provide that context in a way in an observational film. So MIA appears performing though, because I've also, I guess, perhaps just because I'm a big music fan, I think it's important to give flavors in documentaries. It's not just talking heads. And obviously it was a very, you know, it was a nighttime performance. It was a quite, I mean, when people watched, there was all these glow sticks, and I just thought that it was nice to show that. But we also have the UK Iraqi, some of you listeners might know about Loki, who's a good friend of mine, and he's a UK Iraqi hip hop artist, and extremely intelligent and person who's who was speaking at that event. And so I began my sort of clip. That scene begins with some excerpts of the speech he gave, which I thought were extremely powerful. And you know, John Pilger spoke at that event, and Lisa Longstaff from Women Against Rape. So yeah, I mean, I think there's a number. Nils Melzer, the UN rapporteur on torture, was at that event. And so we include four of, say, nine speakers. And obviously we include the best of excerpts from those speeches, to provide that context, and hopefully in a way that doesn't detract from the general flow of the film.
Well, thank you for that, Pablo. I guess that's pretty, we're actually running a bit out of time because this is a Zoom account that is going to be used for another purpose soon. I guess I wanted to ask, do you guys have any kind of final comments you'd like to make? And also I can advertise the film screening at the end after you make your final comments, so that's all good.
I mean, just that, you know, I would, as I say, it was a film that was made irresponsibly, in the sense that I had other projects. COVID came, those projects were delayed. So it was, you know, no budget. It was a truly independent film, the kind of film that I said I wouldn't be making anymore. In the sense that, you know, I have a family, I live in London, but I felt that it had to be made. And there are other films that will come out later after the extradition hearing, but it's a film that I wanted to come out before the extradition hearing, because I hope as many people as possible can watch it. And there are plans afoot to make sure that that's the case. You know, we have a Spanish language premiere on Sunday. There'll be, you know, versions in Italian, French, Portuguese, and hopefully other languages. So yeah, I'm trying to get the film out there as much as possible, and I look forward to Saturday.
Yeah, thank you very much, Pablo. Now, for listeners' information, Green Left is going to be organising a film screening on Saturday, 7 p.m. Well, it's not necessarily organised entirely by Green Left. It's organised by also Pablo himself and a number of other groups as well, but Green Left is one of the co-sponsors of the event, and it's going to be happening at 7 p.m. this Saturday. If you go on the greenleft.org.au website, you'll be able to find details on how to book your ticket and be able to attend the screening. And there's also going to be a Q&A as part of the film screening, which will feature Pablo himself and a number of other important people. So yeah, thank you very much, Pablo. And
See you on Saturday, hopefully.
Yeah, I'll see you on Saturday. Okay.
Thanks.
Anyway.